I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Destin Jenkins, a history professor at the University of Chicago and the author of the new book, The Bonds of Inequality, Debt, and the Making of the American City, which we'll be discussing today. Destin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, David. I really appreciate it.
So first of all, give us a sense of the story you tell in the book.
Sure. Let me kind of begin with chronological markers. The book deals roughly with the period between 1945 and the early 1980s. In a sense, to kind of think about the transition from the so-called golden age of American capitalism, really a period of low interest rates when it came to the municipal bond market, to the beginnings of the so-called second gilded age, the moment of profoundly high interest rates, and tries to think about the dilemmas of American cities, the turn towards retrenchment and select forms of privatization, but at the same time, trying to think about the structural inequities that were generated during the golden era of American capitalism. So that's the chronology. But the book is about how municipal bond finance, or really the business of issuing, underwriting, buying, and investing in municipal debt, proved a powerful generator of different and overlapping inequities. So the book talks about inequality in terms of racial inequality, spatial inequality, and wealth inequality, which I'm happy to speak about and parse a bit more. And in a sense, it takes a sleepy industry, the municipal bond industry, and puts it at the center of discussions of infrastructure inequality and urban democracy. I mean, so many of the great works of recent years have looked at the nexus of those topics, those themes, in terms of mass incarceration, for instance, or different changes in the meanings of work, the location of work. But what I try to do is explore those issues, again, infrastructure inequality and urban democracy, by focusing in on a sleepy industry of bond financiers, traders, bond attorneys, and others.
And a couple of questions. First of all, how did you decide to focus on, as you called it, a seemingly sleepy industry, municipal debt, and then you focus only on San Francisco? You did your graduate work at Stanford, so it may have been that it was easy to get to San Francisco, but were there other reasons that you chose both municipal debt and then the city of San Francisco?
Yeah, really great questions. Let me begin with the municipal debt piece. So I went to graduate school with no interest in municipal bond finance. I was a history major as an undergrad. I had no background really in finance, aside from reading the archives and trying to figure out the story and the ways the key architects of the bond industry actually understood it and helped to build out that world. But so really the flashpoint for me was the bankruptcy of the city of Detroit in July 2013. You know, there was this discussion of haircuts and public assets up for grabs and what would happen to the long-term obligations to pensioners. And so as somebody at that point in the course of my graduate career, I knew I wanted to write about inequality. At first, the story I thought I would write would be about city planning. But again, that July 2013 moment was really a flashpoint, because when you think about the language, right, in the terms, for instance, people like Kevin Orr appointed as an emergency manager, that raised questions of democracy. The question of who would be forced to take a haircut was a matter of redistribution. The question of the future prospects for funding the public in the context of a 30-year project of privatization and austerity was implicitly, if not explicitly, an issue of the quality of life, of urban life. And all of this in a predominantly Black city raised questions around the racial politics of municipal debt. But of course, Chapter 9 bankruptcy is exceedingly rare. So the question for me then was, in the absence of such a dramatic event, how did the municipal bond market and municipal debt shape the distribution of resources and condition Black future? So that's how I got to municipal debt, really the kind of the major event, July 2013. But my interest in San Francisco came from walking with my dad from the Ferry Building in San Francisco to downtown San Francisco. And at that point in time, we had been to numerous stadiums around the country, baseball stadiums, you know, it's just kind of father-son experience. But we always comment on the demographics, the built environment. And when we were in San Francisco in early 2010, it was clear, we asked each other, where are the Black folks? And then we finally got to the Tenderloin in downtown San Francisco, and we found the Black folks. And really, for me, that left a lasting impression, which is to say, how in a city that is liberal, is seen as a progressive city historically, especially compared to other cities in the Sun Belt, how does the city still have such problems around racial inequality? So then the historiographical question was, what is the relationship between anti-Blackness and colorblind liberalism? And that was why I focused in on San Francisco, a very different place than, again, Oakland, Detroit, where historians up until that point had started to tell the story of the rise of modern conservatism, the rise of populist conservatives and paring back the welfare state. Well, in San Francisco, those folks hold relatively little power. And so then the question again became, what is the relationship between anti-Blackness and an articulation of liberalism in the quintessential liberal city? In structuring inequities and kind of shaping and really curtailing Black futures.
This is really interesting because one of the striking things about your book is that, as you said, you don't think of San Francisco as an African-American city. I think there's a, you have a chart in your book of breaking down the city's population by race or ethnicity over the course of the 20th century. And I think at its height, San Francisco has at most maybe 14 or 15% African-American population. So as a reader, I was wondering as I worked through your book, how to interpret that, how to fit that fact into the story you tell.
Yeah. So that was, you know, what was really intriguing about San Francisco as a site, as a case study, if you will, is because the second great migration for other American cities, that is the great migration of African Americans from the American South to places like Chicago, Detroit, New York. So the second great migration around World War II was basically San Francisco's first great migration and arguably only great migration of African Americans from the South. And so that was really interesting because whereas other stories would place and talk about the kind of Black presence and what it meant for the politics, economy, sociality of places like Chicago and elsewhere, and really talk about that story in terms of the early 20th century. Well, Black folks are relatively latecomers to the city of San Francisco. And then the question was, how does that affect or shape the racial axes, the racial hierarchy, which had largely been defined along a white Asian axis? So that was really just an interesting point for me to explore in the book. But to the question about San Francisco and the anti-Blackness that really kind of structures the distribution of resources, what we have to think about here is people like Kianga Yamada Taylor's work. And what she shows is the ways in which the U.S. housing market from the very beginning, or at least from the early 20th century onwards, is structured by anti-Blackness. It's expressed through the ideas of real estate agents, mortgage bankers. It's institutionalized and amplified through federal housing policies in the late 1930s. But if she's right, and if folks are right to think about the relationship between anti-Blackness and housing markets, and more broadly, the ways in which economic transactions across markets shape and create the terms of racial subordination, then we need to bring that same point to bear on the municipal bond market. I mean, so that's one of the things the book explores, is that you, in other words, you don't necessarily need a sizable Black population for some of the articulations and expressions of anti-Blackness to manifest themselves. And I think San Francisco is the case study that kind of proves that, or at least, you know, suggests that rule.
And just a brief note, the book you referred to, I believe, came out in 2019 is by a professor at Princeton, correct?
That's right. That's thank you, David. That is the fantastic work by Kianga Yamada Taylor at Princeton University. The book is called Race for Profit, an award-winning book that tries to, again, think about the end of redlining and what she calls the forms of predatory inclusion during the late 60s and early 1970s, the ways in which African-American women in particular were able to secure federally guaranteed mortgages, but the ways in which that actually reified and reproduced some of the inequities that we saw during the early 20th century. So it's a brilliant book that focuses mostly on that period from 1968 to 78. But the larger argument about economic transactions across markets, the housing market in particular, but across markets, and the ways in which that creates the terms of racial subordination is a broader argument that I think must be considered in relationship, again, to other markets, and in my case, the municipal bond market.
And so how does this story look in other cities after World War II? It sounds like it may look very similar, despite the fact that San Francisco is a very different city, say, than Chicago or New York or Detroit or even Los Angeles, obviously, in Southern California.
Yeah, no, another great question. I think my first response is that my book, I think, demands and calls for more research. I mean, certainly I stand on the shoulders of folks who came before me, especially the so-called new urban history of the late 1980s that focused on the work of people like Eric Monkanen, Robin Einhorn, who focused on the local state, focused on municipal debt politics, but largely in select cities, didn't follow the life of a municipal bond, if you will, beyond municipal boundaries. So, you know, I build on that work, but I think we need far more work, new scholarship to consider some of the relationships I explore in my book in relation to other contexts, Buffalo, Miami. I mean, I try to do a little bit of that in my footnotes to the book and in the epilogue, considering Hawaii, for instance, or Puerto Rico, again, Buffalo and other cities. So in short, we need more work to see how this story plays out in other cities. But I will say, I think there are a few similarities and one big difference. The similarities are the general trend towards municipal debt financing across the country. There are going to be some differences in scale. Large American cities compared to small municipalities and the kind of borrowing terms that come along with questions of scale, but also the kind of general trend towards the proliferation of specialized districts, authorities, and agencies with borrowing power. We're also going to turn to the municipal bond market, for instance, redevelopment agencies or public housing projects or specialized school districts or even control boards, as we see in New York or Cleveland or Philadelphia or in Washington, D.C., with tax-exempt borrowing power. So that's the general trend that I think holds. San Francisco is a case study that, again, exemplifies that general trend. I would say that some similarities also are around the pro-growth coalition and its relationship to finance. So one of the things I explore in the book is what I call the infrastructural investment in whiteness. This is a cross-class, intra-racial white compact whereby white workers secure unionized jobs to build the physical infrastructure on which the white middle class relies for consumption, all the while kicking up rents upwards towards bondholders in the form of tax-exempt interest income. And so I think that kind of compact between the pro-growth coalition of which organized labor was a part and its relationship to finance holds for about 20 years or so, roughly between 1945 to the late 60s. So I venture to say that we see that coalition elsewhere, as we also see the kind of infrastructural investment of whiteness and far too often the ways in which Black communities are rendered unworthy of debt. And the last thing I will say, though, just in terms of a difference is, and really is also a chronological one, especially by the time we get to the early 1970s, is this kind of shift from Black power to Black politics, right, is one of the kind of dominant narratives where we see Black mayors in Detroit, in Cleveland, in Gary, Indiana, in New York with David Dinkins. But the ways in which Black politics then reshapes and expands in some cases the public sector through the form of affirmative action policies, for instance, in hiring of Black police officers in places like D.C., we don't see that same kind of shift, in short, from Black power to Black politics in a place like San Francisco, because, for instance, the reasons you mentioned, David, in part because of the small presence. And it's not until the election of Willie Brown in the late 1990s that we actually see the presence of a Black mayor, whereas other cities had experienced that transition far before.
So, Dustin, you mentioned visiting the new baseball stadium in San Francisco with your father, which is downtown. But of course, when the Giants moved from Brooklyn, they moved to Candlestick Park in the late 50s. And that was a project financed with municipal debt. So tell us how your thesis works, or in the example of Candlestick Park, how the money moves among the various actors there.
Absolutely. So this is, you know, a great question. It allows me to elaborate a bit more on the point about the infrastructural investment in whiteness. So if we could just kind of take two slices of that intra-racial cross-class compact. If we think about who are the actual investors, who are the actual bondholders at mid-century, we're largely talking about institutional investors and wealthy individuals. I can specify a bit more with the institutional investors. We're largely talking about select insurance companies and also wealthy individuals who can, again, both of whom can forego, you know, say $1 million for 25 to 30 years and retrieve that principal further out into the future, all while collecting taxes and interest income through, for instance, semi-annual payments. So we're talking about folks who have capital to lend, because that's, in fact, what a bond really is. And so if we think about the identities, for instance, of wealthy individuals, a little harder to kind of decipher because of the role of fiduciaries. But if we think about the history of wealth in this country, the racialization of wealth, we're talking largely about white folks who have the capital, who are seeking to shield their capital from high federal marginal tax rates. We're largely talking about white wealth and white wealthy individuals. So in that sense, that's the kind of racialization, the upward racialization of a revenue stream, right? By way of being a bondholder, able to secure tax exempt interest income that mostly benefits white wealthy individuals. So that's the kind of upper class component that we see around, for instance, the construction of a baseball stadium. But we're also talking about white workers, the white workers in segregated building trades, who, again, are literally building the physical infrastructure that would allow for the San Francisco Giants to play ball. And so in that sense, that's what we're talking about. But it's different, right? I mean, this brings up the analytical difference between wealth and wages, for instance, right? We're thinking about wealth in the form of tax-exempt interest income and by virtue of being a bondholder versus white workers who are able to secure segregated wages based off of racial discrimination and exclusion, even in the city's building trade. And there's some great work by Joshua Rosen. I don't talk too much about this in my book, but I rely on him a little bit here. He talks about which kinds of firms were able to secure the contracts, right, to provide for the basic materials that made possible the construction of the stadium, and the ways in which many Black folks, especially in the late 1960s here in the Bay Area, had to organize and raise hell because they weren't securing the contracts to, again, provide the basic infrastructural materials that was so crucial, obviously, to the built environment. So that's the kind of two class components of the infrastructural investment in whiteness, while underscoring and punctuating the difference between wealth and wages.
The year 1966 is a critical hinge in your book. It kind of marks the end of that golden age of American capitalism, at least for certain people. Tell us about what happened that year in San Francisco and in the municipal bond market.
You know, we start to think about turning points, right? And this goes to the question of storytelling. In many ways, if you think about the urban histories that have been so important, so generative, and also the American political histories and economic histories, even really, it's the early 70s, right? 1973 is often seen as a crucial turning point in many of the narratives. That's where, you know, we see the breakdown of Bretton Woods. That's where we see economic stagflation. That's where we see the beginnings of the second Gilded Age. For me, 1966 is a crucial turning point for two reasons. Because one, it allows me to link the local to dynamics in the bond market. So at the local level, what we're talking about here is the murder of a 16-year-old African-American named Matthew Johnson by a police officer, in the ways in which that generated a great deal of frustrations. And some would call it the urban riots, uprisings, or rebellions. I know there's some great debate about that now, the recent work from Elizabeth Hinton, her book, America on Fire, talks about the difference between a riot versus a rebellion. But regardless of what you call it, one thing's for sure is that those uprisings in September 1966 finally compelled city officials to invest in Black neighborhoods, and in particular, the Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood in Southeast San Francisco that had been neglected for years and years. And because the thesis was that if you don't invest in these neighborhoods and address some of the structural inequities, an urban rebellion could happen again. And to use some of the language of city officials at the time, San Francisco could go the way of Watts, of course, referring to the uprising in Watts in LA in 1965. So it compels city officials to place bond referenda before the electorate to try to finally invest in this divested neighborhood. But at the same time, and this is where the local intersects with the national bond market, is this attempt to borrow occurred at the same time as we see rising interest rates. So across the country, among a variety of borrowers, we see delayed offerings, postponed sales. And we also see a tax revolt against new select bond measures. So in a sense, what we have is a kind of catch-22. On the one hand, city officials are going to try to borrow to resolve parts of the urban crisis and what it represented. And on the other hand, borrowing at high interest rates might actually inflame the tax revolt. And so in a sense, a clash of multiple revolts in the city of San Francisco that is linked to changes in the bond market and more precisely what's been described as the credit crunch of 1966. And so in the book, what I try to show is the revolt of Black San Franciscans intersecting, colliding perhaps with the revolt of select property owners, some of whom are also African Americans. And 1966 becomes the turning point in my book because that's really the end of this 20-year period of relatively low interest rates, not uninterrupted, to be sure, but the end of a kind of low interest rate regime and the rise of a high interest rate regime, which is going to condition all kinds of avenues, solutions, and in many ways presage the kind of retrenchment and privatization that has kind of come to define the last 40 or 50 years.
And in the late 60s, it becomes harder and harder for the city of San Francisco to get voter approval for bond issuances. In California, under California law, the city needs two-thirds approval to do that. Those votes become harder to get, in part because of skepticism from the Black community and the Asian American community in San Francisco that this money will, in fact, benefit them. So how does that, the difficulty in getting that vote, change how San Francisco accesses the capital markets and the power that the municipal bond entities have over the city?
Yeah, just to go to the first part of the question, one of the interesting things I think in the story is what I kind of describe as a form of Black bond politics. And, you know, I suppose one could slice that and be offer a kind of nuanced take on what that politics represents, the different components that is of Black bond politics. I mean, for instance, one expression of Black bond politics could be the idea of Black capitalism, right? Investing in the local municipal bonds, for instance, of a municipality to not only demonstrate citizenship, but also to secure tax exempt interest income. So that's one expression of Black bond politics. But one of the things we see in San Francisco is especially articulated in the Black press, the African American Sun Reporter, a newspaper here in the city of San Francisco, is a kind of withdrawal, right? A usage of the boycott to demand changes in hiring practices within city government, political appointments to the Public Utilities Commission, for instance, in the sense of trying to withdraw the voting power of Black San Franciscans and to effectively torpedo local bond issues. So, you know, this great kind of commentary from folks in the Sun Reporter that, you know, for 20 plus years, we've supported these bond issues and have gotten very little in return. But we would be wise, the argument went, to basically adopt the strategies of the wider civil rights movement around the boycott, boycotting, for instance, Woolworths or other kinds of sites of direct consumption. Boycott local bond referenda until we get what we deserve. That is appointments, infrastructural investment in our communities, and a form of broader form of taxation with representation. So that was something you see in the late 1960s, which becomes part of a broader revolt in the city against these local bond issues. And that is going to trigger the acceleration of the reliance of city government on one, specialty districts, which are described even in the financial press as a borrowing dodge, right? The creation of these different kinds of entities with borrowing powers that are, you know, professed or ostensibly have their own sort of independent revenue base. But if in the event of a shortfall, it's the city government and taxpayers in particular, we're going to have to generate enough revenues to pay bondholders. So it's described as a borrowing dodge. But what we see is a kind of proliferation of such entities to try to finance infrastructure because of this wider tax revolt in the city of San Francisco. And also the reliance, for instance, on bonds that don't have to meet the same two-thirds threshold for voter approval, just 50% plus one. for instance, but which also may come with higher interest rates when floated on the wider municipal bond market. So there is a way in which this kind of works in the favor of bond financiers, because the rejection of these local bond issues and the turn towards these, what's again described as borrowing dodges in the issuance of much costlier bonds to finance infrastructure projects results in or plays into the favor of bond financiers and investors who, again, are able to secure higher interest payments over other more standard bond issues, for instance, like general obligation bonds. So as I said, that's a long story that really speaks to the revolt against the downstream effects of a debt compact, a post-war debt compact, the ways in which the city is going to be compelled to still finance those critical infrastructure projects to resolve parts of the urban crisis, but how in so doing it plays into the hands of financiers in the form of higher interest payments.
So is it fair to say that bond rating agencies and the financiers become in some ways shadow city governments over the course of your narrative? Do they exert more power in, say, the 70s and thereafter than they would have in the 50s? And are people aware of that transition?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that question of outsized power as in the differences between outsized power in the 50s relative to the 1970s. I'm tempted to say that in the 70s, the power is much greater, and especially by the 1980s because of the cuts to federal aid to American cities under Reagan. So by the time we start to talk about the forms of federal and even state level retrenchment during the 1980s, now cities are thoroughly in the lion's den in the sense that they're even more reliant on the municipal bond market at a time of dramatically high interest rates. And so the power of financiers is just going to be much greater because of the structural dependence and the absence of alternative ways of generating revenue, securing aid. So I'm tempted to say that the 1980s, the power is much greater than in the 1950s. But you asked a great question about rating agencies as shadow governments. I think in the book, there's somewhat of a tension, if I could step back and be critical of my own work. And the tension is this. On the one hand, rating agencies do wield power, but on the other hand, not so much or not nearly as much as some believe. And so what I'm trying to figure out is what is the power of rating agencies? And one of the things I know is these guys offered a service, and they are a handful of guys. I mean, in the late 1960s, it's just a handful of folks. I mean, even going back to Moody's, for instance, we're talking about the kind of small staff between 1920 and 1935. There's a staff that's never greater than four people. So it's a small group of folks who have a huge responsibility in terms of evaluating the credit profiles of American cities. The small staff is generally true into the 1960s. But what is the nature of that power? It's not they're the new masters of capital, to quote the title of one book, but they offer a service that became essential. And that was less of a cabal or in the sense of kind of like parasites in some back room who were able to sort of plot and latch on to the city and distort its priorities in these sort of nefarious ways. But I see it as really through the voluntaristic submission of information. And what you see in the late 30s, early 1940s, and especially after World War II, is officials at Dun & Bradstreet and other rating agencies are going to try to use the carrot, right, to say to municipal officials, submit information to us so that you may borrow at lower rates. And so there's going to be an attempt to advise city officials on how to submit information, the types of information that would lead to lower borrowing costs, which ultimately plays into the business model of rating agencies. After all, they're sellers of financial information. And so it's this attempt to kind of borrow at lower rates that is going to lead to the submission of information, which ultimately expands the surveillance powers of the financial sector, which is key to the power that rating agencies wield. So a shadow government is an interesting way to describe it. I have to think a bit more about that. But how did this happen is through the voluntaristic submission of information. And as to your question of the awareness, I mean, one of the things I hoped for as somebody who's interested in lowercase p politics, if you will, is the ways in which people resisted or were able to undermine these surveillance powers that I just described. I found very little of that in the archives I consulted for the book. I did see revolt against, as I mentioned, the kind of downstream effects of this post-war debt compact, but very little in terms of criticism of rating agencies, except when you get to the early 1970s, some criticism of the outsized power of financiers who live in the suburbs, but who shape the bond issues of the city of San Francisco, who screen and in many ways distort the spending priorities of the city of San Francisco. But I found very little awareness except for people like Wright Patman, William Proxmire in Congress. But I think that speaks to the moment that we're in now, where there is a great deal of awareness over the power, even if we haven't yet diagnosed properly the exact power of these credit rating agencies, a great deal of awareness of the ways in which people you've never met, the institutions you've never heard of, can greatly distort and shape your prospects for employment, home ownership, and so forth. And that was kind of one of the lessons for me in thinking about the 2008 financial crisis. And nowadays, in this particular moment, you have people who are thinking about the power of Moody's vis-a-vis university budgets or credit rating analysts in terms of city services and infrastructure. So I think that speaks to this moment, the ways in which 2008 was such a dramatic turning point, which has heightened the awareness of rating agencies and as a shadow government, if you will, relative to the late 50s and early 60s, in which I didn't find very much awareness of their power.
You mentioned archives. Tell us a little bit just about the research for the book and when and how this subject came alive for you. You mentioned that you hadn't gone to graduate school with the idea of studying the municipal bond market, and yet obviously you spent probably about a decade of your life deeply immersed in it. So what was the body of work that you researched? And then again, when did these people come to life for you?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think just going back to the Detroit bankruptcy, I heard that news of Detroit's bankruptcy in July 2013 while I was a camper, if you will, at the History of Capitalism summer camp at Cornell University. And one of the lecturers was discussing the difference between stocks and bonds. And so it was just really kind of fortuitous, maybe even a coincidence, that on the day that Detroit declared bankruptcy, there was a discussion about bonds and the power of bondholders. And so I was kind of in my mind, just kind of working out or thinking through the relationship between what I was hearing from the visiting lecturer and the news of Detroit's bankruptcy. So I just finished my second year of graduate school, had written a paper about the rise of finance, insurance, and real estate in San Francisco. But at the time, that was largely a city planning story. I had, in other words, no way to think about finance in material terms beyond the creation of commercial office buildings and the kind of physical infrastructure on which the financial, insurance, and real estate sector relied. So I was trying to figure out how do I actually tell the story of markets and financial transactions. And that dovetailed nicely with the summer camp. So that was how I got interested in the bond story. The characters came to life when I was able to find the archival base, which really became the kind of gold mine for me and the basis for the story. That's the Alan K. Brown papers housed at the University of California, Berkeley. And so that was where the kind of abstraction of the bond market, of supply and demand, of market transactions really took personal shape or took the form of the individuals who literally stitched together that market. Brown was a key player for the Bank of America in building out the post-war municipal bond market. By the end of his career in the early 1980s, although he's kind of marginalized by the early 70s, he becomes widely known as Mr. Municipal Bond. I mean, so it was through his archival papers, how he related to his staff, how he tried to appeal for other traders and far more resources to facilitate the business of debt, that the seemingly abstract world of municipal bond market took personal shape. And so that was the key archival discovery. But really, there's then the work of storytelling. I mean, you can have the archives, you can have the sources, but then there's the question of crescendos. There's the question of turning points. You have to think about character development. And graduate school was great. I mean, I had the excellent, excellent model of Richard White's Railroaded, and Richard White was one of my advisors. And so he offered me a kind of critical approach, for instance, to annual reports, to see it as a performance genre and to not take the performance of assets and liabilities for granted. but to employ a more radical methodology in the stories being offered in such documents. So I took that approach and brought it to bear on the articulations and claims of bond financiers in my story. But on the question of storytelling, the excellent work of people like Vince Brown, the Harvard historian who just most recently published a book called Tacky's Revolt. I mean, he's a historian of the Atlantic world, of Atlantic slavery, but he's thought a great deal about cartographic narratives and historical implotment and the ways in which we tell stories. And, you know, historians, we make arguments to be sure, but we also are trying to tell a story. And for me, I had to think very intently about that because I had to tell a story about bond finance. And many people either don't know what that is or find it to be very boring. So the questions of character development, implotment, crescendos, foreshadowing was something that, you know, I was forced to think through in the work of Vincent Brown, the anthropologist David Scott, who's written about C.L.R. James's and his construction of the Black Jacobins. Those were some key works in helping me think not just about how to tell a story about bond finance, but how to do so in interesting ways and compelling ways. And, you know, I hope the book accomplishes that.
And then finally, Destin, tell us what you're working on now, what your next project is or what your next projects are.
Yeah, this is the great, great question, because once you finish a book, you realize if you're lucky, there's life after the first book. And so I'm in the early stages of thinking about what's next. And for me, I think there's really two stories. Well, one book project that really turns around two stories. One part is the fiscal squeeze of American cities post-1970s. So, I mean, I talk about that a little bit at the end of The Bonds of Inequality, for instance, the ways in which Mayor George Moscone applied a kind of scalpel technique in select cuts while also continuing public investment in other areas of economic growth. But I want to talk about the story of the fiscal squeeze of American cities post-1970. Really, you could call it the politics of municipal finance, of revenues, expenditures, debt, and administration. And I want to consider it in relationship to the underground or illicit economy, the race for revenues from the vantage point of municipal officials, and the race away from, if you will, the taxing powers of the state, the attempts by the local state to generate revenues by way of aggressive revenue generating measures, and the ways in which people scrape by in the context of the fiscal squeeze. And so I think what I'm trying to think about in the next project is the business of crime, the business of punishment, and how both pursuits relate to urban fiscal governance post-1970. So that's the spirit of the next project, how to frame it, how to assimilate the war on drugs, the war on crime, the rise of arguably the threat of American fascism, all these ways I have to figure out how to synthesize and integrate. But that's the ambition, a kind of synthetic, accessible monograph that is based on archives that tries to think about those different stories, again, around the underground illicit economy and the fiscal squeeze of American cities post-1970.
Destin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate it. And thanks to all the listeners for tuning in.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.